and a large number of bills. We have a four session starting at 3:30, so we're up against that deadline. I don't know whether we can get excused from the floor. We'll try to do that, but we do want to move along. A number of the bills that we have today is several relating to controlled substances and drug paraphernalia, and some relating to motor vehicles. We also have some bills in here that relate to energy defense. And Judge Snaufer in 1982 sent a memorandum out relating to reduction of court-appointed attorney costs, and that's attracted a considerable amount of attention. We asked around to see if we get some opinions on that, and counsel contacted Susan Mandenberg, who's a professor of law at Lewis and Clark Northwestern School of Law. And I'd like to just ask her if she would come forward to make some general comments about those before we get on into the bills. I know you've got a timeline, and I appreciate your taking the time to come up here for the committee. Professor?
Hi, would you like me just to speak, or did you want to ask questions?
No, actually, I think if you could just sort of give us some general comments, and if you would just for the record give us your name. Okay. On
I'm Susan Mandenberg, professor of law at Lewis and Clark Law School. I've read Judge Snaufer's letter and also a similar letter by Judge Jeldricks, dated April 29th of this year. And I have to say that I think that the committee is being ill-advised in those letters. Both judges seem to think that the law is quite clear. And I've certainly read all the cases they've read and come to a very different opinion than they do. Have to separate it on two different levels, the federal constitution and the state constitution. Under the federal constitution, there are two cases that indicate that counsel only has to be appointed in misdemeanors and petty offenses when jail is imposed. The second of those cases is the stronger of the two on the facts, and it's the Scott case. That case was a 5-4 majority, and the fifth opinion, and the one necessary for the holding, was written by Mr. Justice Powell, who only went along with it because of stare decisis, in other words, previous holdings, and who said in his opinion that he did not think that the imposition of a jail sentence should be the only criterion, that he thought there were other things at issue besides the imposition of a jail sentence. So I would hardly call that law absolutely airtight and engraved in stone. Even if it were, as I'm sure this committee knows, in Oregon, the Oregon Supreme Court follows the Oregon Constitution and almost never reaches the issues under the federal constitution. The leading case in Oregon, as Judge Snaufer's letter points out, is Brown versus Multnomah County District Court. And that case is not on all fours, but it does discuss the issue of court-appointed counsel. And since it mentions the Oregon statutes, especially 135.050, it doesn't clearly reach the constitutional issue. However, it does also mention the Oregon Constitution, so that when Judge Snaufer says, as he does in his letter, that Brown is not a constitutional holding and was only interpreting the Oregon statute, I think he overstates his case. In fact, there's a subsequent Oregon Supreme Court case called State versus Grenvick at 291 Oregon 99, which refers to Brown as a constitutional ruling. Now, it does that in passing, but it's the Oregon Supreme Court doing that in passing, which carries a certain amount of weight. In Brown, the court indicates that the penalty imposed, or the penalty authorized anyway, is certainly one of the indicia of whether something is quote-unquote a crime. It also indicates other indicia, the type of offense, the collateral consequences, whether the community attaches a notion of condemnation to that behavior, and whether the police have the authority to arrest and detain somebody for engaging in that behavior. And so the type of sentence is not the only indication. They do emphasize the type of sentence imposed when they talk about the need for counsel at public expense, but they don't reach the issue of whether counsel would also be required at public expense under other circumstances. They hint that counsel might. So the very most that you can say for Judge Snapper's position, in my opinion, is that he might be right that what he suggests is constitutional. However, he just as equally might be wrong, and in my opinion, he is wrong. We know that the Oregon Supreme Court frequently interprets the Oregon Constitution as giving citizens more rights than the United States Constitution gives us, and there's no reason to assume they would approach it any differently in this case. So what situation would we, as citizens of Oregon, be in if Judge Snapper's suggestions were adopted? Well, it seems to me that at the very least, we would be in a situation where we were having to spend a lot of money to litigate whether his suggestions were or were not constitutional. And we would have to be litigating that not only in the state courts, but also in the federal courts if it was found that they passed state constitutional muster. So that's an expense. If he's wrong and his suggestion is not constitutional, that means there are hundreds, if not thousands, of convictions, depending on how far we go until it gets litigated, that are going to have to be reversed for failure to provide counsel. Now, what happens when they get reversed? Well, first of all, there's expense to litigate those, either by direct appeal or by post-conviction, which, as you all know, can go on forever, no deadline. If they get reversed, probably the state could bring those charges again. I don't think there'd be any double jeopardy problem, assuming they could find the witnesses and still had the evidence. But then, of course, there'd be that double expense of relitigating every single one of those cases. Let's say he's right, and counsel doesn't need to be provided. I think that there are going to be two collateral effects of following that suggestion. One was kind of recommended or suggested to me this morning, talking to some people from the Attorney General's office, and I can't represent that this is what they would testify if they came in. But they were discussing with me the problem that they encounter when the lawyer on the other side of a case does a poor job of briefing the case. They feel the need to overcompensate, and they end up having to argue the case against the state and the case for the state at the same time. They would end up doing the same thing in cases where there was no lawyer on the other side of the case, I have no doubt, because they're ethical people and they care about justice. And that brings me to the second point, and that is that there are times when a lawyer is needed in a case, even though no prison is contemplated, because there are legal problems with the case. The person shouldn't even be fined. The person shouldn't have that conviction going against his or her name because there have been legal errors made or because the prosecutor or the police have been overzealous. We could expand the examples virtually forever. And so I think that even if his suggestions are constitutional, they're unwise, not only from a policy point of view, but also from a fiscal point of view. This is not going to be the big money saver that he says it's going to be, is my prediction. The expenses may be more hidden, but I think that they're going to be there. I would also throw in a word of caution about another suggestion that I've heard is floating around, and that is that the Oregon and the federal constitutions only require the provision of a warm body with a law degree, and that the level of competence of the lawyer is not a particular issue. I would really caution against slipping into that approach, even if you don't have ethical problems or policy problems with that. There, as far as I know, is no case that okays a system that makes it impossible for criminal defense attorneys to do an adequate job. Cases go on a lawyer-by-lawyer basis, and they say, well, this lawyer may or may not have done everything she should have done in this situation. But I don't know of a situation where the whole system has been challenged, and I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that the challenge would work, or that the system would pass muster. It seems to me that there is one solution that I have heard put forth that is legally competent, and it goes back to those indicia of seriousness that the Supreme Court laid out in Brown. If you're talking about labeling something a violation, it changes the picture. No longer does it hold that community sense of condemnation. No longer do the police have the ability to arrest and detain, for example. It changes the constitutional context in which all this is being considered. And certainly it's within the legislative competence to look hard at criminal statutes and see which should or shouldn't be called crimes. It may also change the context to give that discretion to the judge. That, I think, is chancier, but it's more along those lines. There may be suggestions. Those are the suggestions I've heard put forth, and that's why I'm reacting to those. I'm not particularly advocating any of them. I'm reacting from a constitutional point of view as to where I think they stand on the spectrum.
Thank you very much. One of the problems that I think that we're faced with here is, the difficulty that I'm having with this whole process in the area of indigent defense is that there was a substantial increase in the cost of the state of providing that defense over the last couple of years. But I'm not certain, and have not been certain as we've been going through looking at this, we were sort of given a mandate from the Ways and Means Committee, who does not set policy theoretically, but has done so in the budget process to reduce costs. And so it was a chase to go out and find mechanisms by which we could do that. In establishing the Indigent Defense Board, which was set up in the last legislature, we sort of said, okay, board, there you are. You now have 1.5 staff persons in the telephone. Go fix this problem, which was probably far more than anyone should be asked to do. Now we're being told to find some reduction of costs through a number of administrative mechanisms that I'm not certain will work. And in a sense, we're on a fishing expedition, and I don't think that's a good way to make policy, personally, and I was pleased to hear that there is a differing view. I'm not going to stand here and debate either the judges or your opinions on this matter, because I don't feel confident to do that, but it's a little bit of a sort of a let's all jump on and do something like this so that we can find ways to reduce the costs. And I'm not certain that there are, that in fact the issue that we're dealing with is not some matters over which we have no control.
Well,
the national crime index just went up 6%, and for instance, and we don't control that situation. So and the real costs are on the far end of the scale and not necessarily even the violators. And I'm getting to a question here in a roundabout way. Going through and reviewing crimes and reducing those to violations or infractions is a legitimate thing. I think it ought to happen. In fact, periodically, it's probably a good idea to go back and review what we have done, because there are reactions that we do in setting laws here often that may be an overreaction given the circumstance of time. But to do that solely to try to find a reduction of costs is not necessarily the right way to approach that. And I think that's what I hear you saying, is that that's a...
Well, I mean, I sympathize with the committee's dilemma and with the legislature's dilemma. The costs are going up for everything the government is asked to do. The constitutional issues and the policy issues are not always the same issues. I mean, there's some things that are constitutional to do that are unwise to do. But I mean, I've been down at this legislature every session for at least the last four sessions talking to this subcommittee about this exact same problem. And so I know that it's one of the hardest nuts to crack. I think that simplistic solutions to difficult problems only dig deeper holes. It's not always easy to predict what the hole is going to be, but I think it is always easy to predict that there will be one. And I think that specifically Judge Snapper's suggestion is precisely that sort of approach.
Questions?
Thank you.
Professor, thank you very much for coming down. I know you're probably going to dash back and give some of your law students a test, and we'll let you get on your way. Thank you for coming down. I appreciate that. Okay, I'll move back to onto the schedule. No, I don't really want to I'll tell you what I like to do is we actually 3385 is scheduled here as a work session, but that's actually it needs to be a hearing. But we don't have the amendments on that yet, so we need to get those down here, and there is someone here to be heard on that matter. So I think I want to go to 2386, which is relating to drug paraphernalia, and I think there may be some people here to speak on that. But you have some amendments, I believe, to that. So we'll go to the work session on 2386.
Is it scheduled just for work session? I don't know if anybody was here to testify. I've talked to you about and to other members about the proposed amendments. I thought I'd read those into the record and then make them, given that those would be approved, make a motion on the bill.
Okay.
I guess people from the audience could stand up and say if they wanted to be heard on it or not.
Frank is listening
on the TV.
Oh, Frank's listening on the TV?
Yeah.
Good.
Tell them the amendments are coming.
Frank, these are the amendments. They're coming your way. Is that clear enough?
Sure.
Okay. If you can open up your bill file and the bill. And I've got these written down so I can give them to counsel, Mr. Chair, so they're pretty clear.
Just before you get, there is someone I know who will want to address on that. I'm going to go ahead with the amendments now.
Okay. Page 2 of the bill, line 40 through 43, I suggest deletion. Members during the last hearing will recall that there was some concern as to the comprehensiveness of the bill. So I would delete those issues on page 2 that were an issue, and that's sub H and I. And then I would look on page 3 of the bill, line 4, sub L, objects used, comma, intended for or designed, and insert the word specifically for the use in ingesting, inhaling, or otherwise inducing marijuana. If you have any questions on any of these, I think I've talked. On line 7 of the bill, after hashish heads, put the semicolon there and delete the word or punctured metal bowls. Moving down on page, still on page 3 of the bill, after line 20 where we've got M, add a line N, which would be the new line 21, and it would be N, and it would read artificial lighting specifically designed for the propagation of a controlled substance. If you remember, there was testimony repeatedly saying we've got to add something about grow lights. Well, there's lots of legitimate reasons for grow lights also, and this would address that. And then on page 4 of the bill, on line 34, after the word school fund, add earmarked for drug education, comma.
I'm sure. Where is that again?
Line 34 on page 4.
Sure.
After the word school fund, if you remember, there was people talked about what's the that money, if any, was collected, what would it go for, and it'd be put in the common school fund, and then it would read earmarked for drug education, comma, prevention and rehabilitation programs, period, which would make it clear to everybody. And then on line 36, the first word of that line is should, and it's been suggested, and I will propose an amendment changing that word to shall consider. And most of those are to address some of the concerns that were raised in the previous hearing. So, Mr. Chair, and I guess if you're ready for a motion, I could make the motions as amended to them as the amendments that I just read.
those, okay, we would accept those as, the motion would be to accept those as conceptual amendments, since we don't have an LC draft form, but those are these being drafted?
I've got them written out, and they're so, actually, there's really no...
they're hand engrossed.
Yeah, they're hand engrossed, and there won't be any problem putting them in LC form. They're, because most of them, the significant ones, are deletions.
Okay, do you want to make that motion in reference to
I would move the amendments to House Bill 2386 as I read into the record on page 2, 3, and 4.
Representative Phillips moves amendments to House Bill 2386 as indicated on pages 2, 3, and 4. Any discussion on that, on the amendments? Any objections to those amendments? If not, that's so ordered. Okay, so the bill, are there any other amendments or questions on that, on the bill? Nelson, do you have someone who wanted to comment on this? Sure. Don't you have a seat? I'm sorry. You want to go ahead? You want to give your name?
I'm Alcott Thompson. I'm here on behalf of the Independent Business Council, which is a group of small retailers in the state. And they have some concerns, and as well as I do as an attorney, over some constitutional problems with House Bill 2386. The bill, as I believe everybody knows, is based on the DEA's Model Drug Paraphernalia Act. And that act, quite frankly, has been upheld numerous times on pre-enforcement challenge basis. Unfortunately, as it's turned out in the states, it's having substantial problems in its actual enforcement. All the problems that the Supreme Court of the United States has identified as to its vagueness problems, as well as the various federal circuit courts, are showing up in practice. You know, the problems of the definitions and as to what is actually prohibited, and as the committee should know, any law that creates a crime must give persons subject to that law fair notice of what the prohibited conduct is. The problem with 2386 is it just doesn't do that. Many of the items identified even in the definition sections or in the sections of labeling out these specific things, items can and do have legitimate uses. A good example are baggies. Baggies are used for many reasons, and they're also used for packaging controlled substances. And the problem is sellers of items don't necessarily know what those things are going to be used for, and that's the precise problem with the vagueness. Interestingly enough, in 1986, in response to a request from Representatives Johnson and Markham, Attorney General Dave Fulmeyer reviewed what was Senate Bill 598, which was from the 1985 session of this of the legislature, which was the same bill as 2386. And Mr. Fulmeyer concluded, and I disagree with his conclusion, that the bill wasn't on its face vague. But he also concluded that the bill wouldn't do what everybody was intending it to do. It would not have, and I quote, a sweeping or even a significant effect on the availability of drug paraphernalia. The reason cited by Mr. Frohnmeyer for that was the requirement in the bill of a culpable mental state, essentially intent. Only because intent was in there that Mr. Frohnmeyer could conclude that the bill was not unconstitutionally vague. But the only way the problem's going to be addressed is if you remove intent, which makes the bill unconstitutional. In light of those constitutional problems, and additionally in light of the indication from the Oregon Court of Appeals many years ago in the celebrated case of Gaffney versus Babb, that the Model Drug Paraphernalia Act is probably unconstitutional under the Oregon law, under the Oregon Constitution, we don't think the bill should even get out of this committee. The bill becomes law of the state. It's going to have to spend a large amount of money, both on the prosecution side and then through indigent defense, spending a large amount of money to defend and also challenge the law on constitutional basis. Not passing this bill out of committee won't harm the ability of this state to keep drug paraphernalia out of the hands of children. Oregon law already prohibits the sale to anyone under 18, any device by which controlled substances or tobacco can be introduced into the body. That particular statute, ORS 163-580, doesn't have the constitutional problems that this bill does, as it's clearly drafted and just prohibits everything. The problem with 2386 is you really can't tell what's prohibited by it. And therefore, it has substantial constitutional problems, and we believe that the bill should just stay in this committee and this committee should oppose it.
Okay, thank you. You mentioned, I believe at the opening of your testimony, that there had been some, that this had been tested constitutionally.
Yes, there are no, as best I can tell, reported appellate cases. I am in the process of getting from a colleague a series of cases on a trial court level, on trial court levels, and I will provide those to the committee as soon as I get them, which should be in the next couple of days. That's where all the challenges have been. They haven't, nobody's particularly gone up to the Court of Appeals on the case, on the issue.
Okay, fine. Are there further questions?
Could I have the opinion number if you've got that, sir?
I don't have the opinion number. I just have a copy of the opinion. Oh, excuse me. It's 8176.
8176?
Yes, April 11th, 1986.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. The bill is still before us in work session. And Representative Phillips, Section 3 of the bill, which is on page 4, do you want to move to amend? There's some blanks left there as far as what the violation level would be. Do you want to?
Well, I would suggest a Class A misdemeanor. There are some who are, I will tell you, the co-sponsor along with this bill with me wished a felony, but considering a lot of the other discussions we've had, I would suggest a Class A misdemeanor.
You
would. That would be in both lines 19 and 26.
Can I make that a motion?
Yes.
President Phillips moves to further amend House Bill 2386 on page 4 to include on line 19 and line 26 that the violation would be a Class A misdemeanor. Is there any discussion on those amendments? Is there any objection to those amendments? If not, that's so ordered. That is consistent, I believe, with the delivery question on page 9. Representative Phillips, do you wish to move this to the full committee?
I would move House Bill 2386 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Phillips moves House Bill 2386 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Not, clerk, call roll.
Bauman?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Springer?
No.
Burton?
Aye. Carries. Thank you. Okay, let's go to House Bill. What's the one we just had? 3385. I think, Mr. Manana? This is, before I put him on the spot, I want to find my file on this. Hopefully, this is a hearing. Since we haven't, for some reason I don't have my own bill file on this, but this is a bill that was introduced by me. It basically deals with a problem that has been found in a number of cities in areas around in Oregon on drug houses, or so-called drug houses. The problem is that while it's against the law to sell or deliver or make available controlled substances, often what happens is that in particular houses, these are often turned over and over and over again as a place for essentially retailing or wholesaling drugs. The bill that I introduced here, and the bill you have in front of you, amends ORS 465.110, which is a bill that relates to unlawful practices of establishments for other things that already exist in law, such as prostitution, or in this case also illegal abortions and that sort of thing. We added, I had added into that just the place where controlled substances are delivered. What the bill would then allow to happen in the law is if there was a this is a nuisance abatement law, it would allow the local district attorney or a citizen to ask for a injunction against the activity occurring in that house or a building, and then to further, if they, in fact, after trial, it was found that that was a knowing activity that occurred there, then the local jurisdiction could shut that house down and deny access to that facility for up to 1 year. What we have is some amendments that I would like to have introduced that since the initial drafting of the bill, I wanted to particularly make certain that the that there was an adequate coverage for those landlords who, in fact, may not be aware that these activities were occurring to protect their rights. And secondly, to make certain that it was clear that who we were asking to, if the local law enforcement agencies were to find that somebody was accused of an activity occurring in the house, that the landlord wouldn't have the responsibility of trying to shut that facility down, that that responsibility would be given to local law enforcement.